So it's really good to be here tonight. The reason I thought about this talk is because it's really about something I've been reflecting on over the last year pretty strongly. And a little bit, I referred to it a little bit for the break, the invitation at the break, and a little bit the instructions in the meditation. It's using kind of two metaphors that I'd like to kind of work with tonight. And the first is the metaphor of giving space or opening space. And the second is the metaphor of filling space. So it seems to me that our mindfulness practice, Dharma practice, even the simplest core thing of just sitting still for 30 minutes or just being with yourself is really an act of giving space. Giving space to your experience, giving space to the energies that are making themselves known in your body, heart, and mind, and or giving space to external experience as well. The Buddha talked about being mindful internally and externally, so giving space to other people. And it seems to me that the act of giving space itself is an act of love. It's an act of self-care and kindness. So when I say giving space, what I'm really talking about is attention, giving our attention. And if you think about it, attention, the fact that we can pay attention, that we have awareness that can be focused, we have awareness that knows, and it knows that it knows. We have self-reflecting awareness. I mean, what an amazing thing that we even have that. And it's really, I think, the most precious thing about being human is that we have this knowing awareness. So when we give space to this knowing, we're really giving a gift. Giving a gift to ourselves, when we know how we are, when we acknowledge what's happening inside us, and giving a space, giving a gift to others when we acknowledge what's happening for them. So why is it important to give space? Well, when we give space to our experiences, we digest them. We metabolize them. We learn from them. We grow and change because of our experience. It's kind of like everything that we experience, especially the really intense things, the joys, the sorrows, can become the raw material of our waking up if we experience them with the right attitude. A lot of times we move through our lives and don't really let ourselves feel what we're feeling. But when we give space to what we're feeling, that's when we really have a chance to own our lives fully and to learn and grow and change. When we give space, we become intimate with life, with ourselves, and with life itself. And when we become intimate, wisdom is a distinct possibility. We don't become wise by being half here, half present. We become wise by fully arriving, fully landing in the present moment, whatever that is. When we give space, we see ourselves. We become intimate with ourselves, including the parts of ourselves that maybe we don't want to look at. When we give space, we see the habit patterns of our minds, and we see the stories that we tell ourselves. many of those stories are stories that maybe don't serve us anymore. And we see that. Maybe they never served us. When we give space, we see anger arising. And because we're giving it space, there's something in us that actually knows the anger but isn't angry itself. The awareness is not the content of what it knows. And so when we give space to anger, we may have the reaction of anger, but because we're being aware of anger, we're not believing it entirely. And because of that, the pull of the anger isn't that strong anymore. Our default mode as people is this reactive mode, to grasp after something that's pleasurable, to push away what we don't like, and to ignore or space out around what's kind of in between. The mindful mode, the giving space mode, is completely different. When we sit still and do nothing except try to be present with our breathing, we learn so much about what's going on inside. So much in the about what's happening in our hearts, our minds. And which is why it's so important to give ourselves this space, because we live very busy lives and it's actually quite easy to miss our lives. So giving space puts us into relationship with the world. Now, unfortunately, the world that we're living in, this modern world that we're living in, has a lot more to do with filling space than it has to do with giving space. And that's the second metaphor that we'll look at. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the ways that we fill space. The ways that we get so busy that we forget to notice what's really here. And I'd like to do that by focusing a little bit on a popular concept called multitasking. Does anyone here multitask? Anyone a multitasker? Anyone in recovery from multitasking a little bit? Good. So I was thinking of this whole idea of multitasking and as kind of being a really big value in our culture over the last number of decades. And actually, I was looking the word up, and I was reminded that the word multitasking is originally from computer science. And it actually referred to an IBM computer and was coined in 1965 to refer to different processors in a computer processing different things at the same time. So the idea of human multitasking didn't really enter the lexicon until sometime in the 1970s, I think. And it's the idea that, you know, you work on a little of this for a few seconds or a short period of time. You work on a little of this, you work on a little of this. Then you go back to the first thing, then something else comes in and interrupts you, and you work on that for a little bit of time. And you just kind of create this whole pattern of being with things very, very briefly. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to look for work a number of times and apply for jobs. And one of the things that always really made me nervous was when I would read the job description and it would say, must be able to multitask, must have the ability to multitask. And I'm kind of an introvert. And when I heard that, like, ice ran down my spine. It was just like, oh, what does that mean? And I've got to, like, You know, it just seemed very complicated, multitasking. And the thing is, the multitasking culture that we're in has been made or amplified radically by all the media that we have that's been developing over the last couple of decades. We were bombarded with so much information. And the multitasking is a result of that. We've really taken the multitasking to an extreme. Someone I was working with a couple of years ago, she was mentioning that when she brushes her teeth at night, she's also texting. And I asked her, I said, well, why are you doing that? And she said, well, you know, it's brushing my teeth is not that productive. She actually wanted to text someone, and that meant that the time brushing your teeth was a little bit more meaningful. But this is actually, you know, this is, you know, not an atypical story. So multitasking is one of the most prominent symptoms of our lack of intimacy with the present moment. And so the reason that we've decided to multitask, that human beings decided to multitask, is it was kind of a maladaptive coping mechanism for all of this information that we're bombarded with. Now, it turns out that there's been a lot of science done around multitasking. And I like quoting some scientific studies because I think it's quite interesting to think that neurologically, awakening or freedom can be kind of mapped out neurologically, and you can also see the lack of awakening and freedom. You can also, there are correlates in the brain that can often relate to those things. So for one thing, human beings only have one processor. So we really can't pay attention to multiple things at once. It's kind of a misnomer that we even say multitasking. The mind is really more of a one-way highway. The other thing that science has been showing about multitasking is that it's less effective. And one of the reasons it's less effective is because of something called switching time, which means the time that you switch from the one activity to another. I was reading something about these two workers who were, their productivity was mapped. And there was one worker whose productivity was like 80%. So 80% of the things she did during the day was actually something that needed to be done. So that was like an 80%. And she, during an typical eight-hour day, she would switch 275 times. Which, you know, that sounds like a lot, right? But she was 80% efficient. And then the person they were comparing her to, he was like 30% efficient. And he switched about 475 to 500 times during the day, during an eight-hour day. So I thought that was interesting. So when we multitask, we're also more prone to make mistakes. And even though we think we're trying to, you know, get things done or handle things, all this information that's coming at us, you know, multitasking is an attempt to deal with that. But actually, it's much more stressful to multitask than it is to unitask, to do one thing at a time. So the big problem with multitasking is that as human beings have been doing this over the last few decades, a lot of multitasking, it's been rewiring our brains. And it's actually been changing the structure of our brains to become less efficient, to become more stressful, and to make more mistakes. And the other thing that multitasking has been rewiring our brains to do is to be to have minds that wander a lot more. So with all this new information that's coming in, and with this multitasking that we do, we are conditioning ourselves to have a wandering, to have more wandering minds. And it turns out that the more our minds wander, the less happy we are. So there was a study done in 2010 out of Harvard using iPhones, and they collected 250,000 data points. And the study consisted of this, I'm quoting, researchers contacted 2,250 volunteers at random intervals to ask what they were doing, how happy they were, whether they were thinking about what they were doing at that moment or about something else that was pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant. And the study author concluded that our mental lives are pervaded to a remarkable degree by the non-present. Our mental lives are pervaded to a remarkable degree by the non-present. And they gave the number, and the researchers, they go on, they said that on average, respondents reported that their minds were wandering 46.9% of the time, and no less than 30% of the time while doing any activity except having sex, which apparently people were very focused when they were doing that. The researcher went on to say that how often our minds leave the present and where they tend to go is a better predictor of our happiness than the activities in which we are engaged. So basically saying that it's more important to pay attention to give space than the content of what we're giving space to. Or another way of saying that is happiness is not bound by what we experience. It's the way we experience it. It's the way we pay attention to it. So the wandering mind makes us unhappy, and the culture of multitasking makes it inevitable that we're going to be wandering. And the problem with a lot of this, with all the information that we're getting in the world, is that it's addictive. It's actually literally addictive. So there's a neurotransmitter is a chemical, a brain chemical. And there's a neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is released into the brain's pleasure centers whenever we get an email, a text, or play a video game. And this is the same little hit that we get from the dopamine is the same hit that we get during drug addiction. So dopamine basically makes us want to seek after other things. It's the chemistry of craving. And it's really, again, it's all about filling space, wanting things, wanting more, and not actually paying attention to what's right in front of us. I remember I was really got into my GPS on my smartphone when I first got my smartphone. And I was driving across the Bay Bridge or something. And I had my GPS on, and I had the robotic voice, giving me directions. And it was great because I was really, feeling like I was being taken care of. And I was on the Bay Bridge, and I got a direction something like this: in 800 feet, back up. And I said, no, I am not going to back up. I'm on the Bay Bridge. What's wrong with you? And here I am. I'm arguing with my GPS robot. And it was fun because it was I knew better than the robot. And I was, in a way, I was really just filling space. Then there's also this interesting phenomenon that I read about recently called phantom smartphone vibrations. And this is something that they've been studying. And it, apparently it happens for a certain percentage of the population, a significant percentage, which is that you're walking somewhere and suddenly you feel your phone vibrate. You reach for it and actually it wasn't vibrating, you just felt it. So, and actually I think that's happened to me once or twice. So there's this whole thing about wanting to have that faith, that space filled by something. Wanting to see that little blue light that flashes on your phone that tells you you've gotten a message. I also have I have several email accounts, and this is a kind of a confession. I have one email account, and my emails have different tones when I get a email. And there's one email, which is my business email, and every time I get that tone, I may have made money. And so what I've tried to do is basically shut off my notifications, because when I get that notification, it's like there's a little jolt, that dopamine kind of kicks in. And it's really just interesting to watch myself experience that desire to fill space with something else besides this moment. So, filling space is asking, what can I do now to feel happy, safe, and secure? Giving space is asking, what's true now in my direct experience? See the difference? Whole different way of framing it. So what happens when we stop filling space? What happens when we give space? In a sense, that's really when we begin to bring our lives back into balance. Because a lot of our lives are out of balance with all the doing, so much doing that we forget how to be. Now, I have to be careful here. We're not living in a monastery. We're not living in a situation where the environment is supporting us to give space. Our world is not supporting us to give space, generally, because of how it is. We live in the world of doing. We take action. And there's nothing wrong with that. Doing is not the problem. But if all we are is the sum of our doing, then we've forgotten how to be, and we're not really alive. We're not really alive if we've forgotten how to be. So it's, I think it's, in you know, as householders, it's critically important to do this practice, this Dharma practice, this practice of what I'm calling giving space, because without that giving space to the totality of who we are, we just become human doings. And another little science or medical thing around that is that when all we do is do and we don't be, what happens is it actually is bad for our health. They say 80% of all illness is related to stress. Well, if we forget our being, we will become depleted and stressed out. It's as simple as that. So it's really critical that we take time to be, that we give space for ourselves. So what does it take to give space in our world? We have a multitasking culture. It's a competitive culture. We're all very, very busy. And it's actually, it can be really hard to give space for ourselves just because of all the things we have going on, because of habit, And it seems to me that there are two primary qualities that are needed to give space. And one is love, and the other is courage. And I want to say a little bit about both of those. There's a translation for the word mindfulness that I really like, that I heard a few years ago, and it's loving awareness. I really like that way of thinking about mindfulness, because mindfulness has this non-judgmental quality. It knows, but it doesn't judge. It discerns, it sees the big picture. It sees what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. But it doesn't judge. It doesn't criticize. So when we give space to ourselves, it's an act of self-care, of self-love. You know, we can have a pain in our knee or an emotional pain. And how often is it the case that instead of paying attention to our pains, either physical or emotional, that we just kind of motor through? And it's actually really easy to do this. I was reminded of this, or have been reminded of this recently in my own life, because for the last few months I've had some back problems. Some back pain, and I've kind of ignored it. You know, I just thought, well, you know, it's just pain. And I was trying to, you know, work through it, work with it a little bit. But then, in the last few weeks, I actually started to stop doing certain things that I thought might be causing the pain. And the pain is still there, but it's interesting. When I stopped doing certain things, I slept on a different bed, and I stopped doing a certain exercise that maybe was hurting me, I was giving space to my back. And just in a week, I've learned so much about exactly where I'm feeling pain in my back. It's completely changed. It was kind of amorphous for weeks as I was motoring through. Now I'm giving space to this physical pain, and it's very specific. So I'm taking care of myself in this way. So when we're not motoring through, when we're giving space to our physical or emotional pain, we're opening up the possibility of healing. When we give space to others, we're being open to them as human beings, amazing human beings. But so often we don't give space to others. So often we act out of habit. You know, we prejudge someone. And all of our biases and our ideas about who people are because of how they look or because of who we think they are, or maybe we know them and we know what they're going to say. And so it's like our experience kind of blinds us to actually seeing the human being that's right here. Suzuki Roshi had a famous quote many of you know. In the mind of a beginner, there are many possibilities. In the mind of an expert, there are few. So when we give space to other people in relationship, we're opening up the beginner's mind again. You know, in conversation, a lot of times, someone is saying something to us, and instead of giving space, we want to give advice. That's filling space. Or instead of giving space, when someone is telling us this really great story, we actually think of a story that's even cooler that we're going to share with them as soon as they stop talking, because this is even a better story than yours. That's filling space. Or maybe someone is speaking to us and we're just not that interested. And so as we nod our heads, we're thinking about our vacation that we're going to take next month. That's filling space and listening. Giving space is doing it really differently. It's bringing us in relationship. There's a science behind this as well. So in a 2012 study, they found that mindfulness lessens this quality called cognitive rigidity. And cognitive rigidity is defined as a tendency to overlook novel and adaptive ways of responding to experience. So it's the idea that our experience itself may blind us to finding simple solutions. There's a cartoon I saw the other day. There's a guy, a mid-level manager, and one of his employees is coming out of a little square office, and the guy is yelling at him. He's going, "Get back inside your cubicle and start thinking outside the box." No. So it's, you know, it's really encouraging to know that this cognitive rigidity, this kind of freezing of the perceptual apparatus, is not something that we're stuck with. We can actually open it up. And one of the things that I really like about studying mindfulness and brain science is just this whole idea that our brains are plastic. It's so fantastic. Because if our brains weren't plastic, this mindfulness would not be working. It would not work. There is this amazing physical correlate that's happening as well. So a great example of loving awareness is actually from the Buddha, and I wanted to just read a passage. This is the Buddha's description of how to work with the mind. And he uses the word bhikkhu, and bhikkhu means monk or practitioner. Here, a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. A bhikkhu understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. A bhikkhu understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. Very simple instructions. So it's interesting that the Buddha doesn't say a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust and then judges the lust and tries getting rid of the lust or analyzes it or tries getting rid of the hatred or tries thinking about it in some way. The Buddha isn't saying that. He's just saying, you know it. You've got this loving awareness towards it, non-judgmental. You're giving space to your mind states. You're not resisting them, but you're knowing them. And this is the key to everything about practice. You're giving space. What a powerful thing to do, to give space to our mind states, especially the really dark ones. The other quality that I think is important for giving space in our lives is courage. And it takes courage to give space to what's true, because what's true is often can be quite painful and difficult. And I have to say, I do not consider myself a very courageous person. But I'd like to share some vignettes about ways in which I experienced fear. and practice how practice transformed my fears in ways that I couldn't have imagined, and actually helped me give space during difficult times in ways that I could never have imagined. I grew up actually as quite a fearful person, and I kind of grew up with a lot of the fear that I got from being in a relationship with my mom, who was also very fearful. And so I kind of grew up with a lot of fear, and actually there was quite a fair amount of trauma as well in my life when I was a boy. And one of the ways that I worked with being fearful was, as I got into my 20s and 30s, is I began writing. And then as I got a little older, I started writing scary novels and stories. And so writing scary novels and stories was my way of working through my fears and actually kind of working creatively with kind of some of that landscape, my inner landscape of fear. And then I became a Buddhist in 1994. And a few years after I'd started practicing, and fear was still very much up for me at this point, I found myself in the Asian Art Museum. And I went into a room, and it was a room filled with Buddhist statues. You know, beautiful artifacts, old statues. And I walked up to this one statue, and it's the statue, a standing statue of the Buddha, where he's standing and he's doing this. Do you know what this means? So this is the mudra, the hand gesture, traditional, that basically means fear not. Fear not. And I guess in ancient India, if you met someone on the road and you wanted to show that you had nothing, you know, you weren't threatening, you would hold up your hand to say, hey, there's nothing here, fear not. But for the Buddha to do this, it has a completely deeper meaning, because it's like he's saying, follow this path and you have nothing to fear. And when I saw that statue, I began to weep. And I'm weeping there in this room filled with statues, and I'm going, what the hell is this about? And actually, it was at that moment that I realized, oh, actually, I am a Dharma practitioner. This is the Dharma. This stuff is really, it's in my heart. That's when I really knew, when I just spontaneously began weeping at fear not. But there are a couple of vignettes I'd like to share about how fear really changed for me, because I was able to give space. I used to work for a gentleman who used to yell at people. He would like kind of scream really loudly. And he made it very uncomfortable for his employees. And I worked for him for a number of years, and he would yell at me, and I would feel really scared. And then at a certain point, I discovered that I could yell at him back, and that I was able to do that. And I discovered that yelling at him back, whenever he yelled at me, felt really good for about 5 seconds. Felt great for 5 seconds. But then after that, I felt even worse, because I'm not a yeller. And it just totally took me out of my comfort zone. And I was like, walked on eggshells around this guy. And then at a certain point, I began practicing, began meditating. And about a year after I started meditating, the following story happened. My boss called me up. He asked me a question. I gave him an answer he didn't like, and he started yelling at me over the phone. And I said very calmly, oh, you know, you can't speak to me that way. We're not going to be able to solve the problem if you yell at me. And I said it just like that. And he went, what? And I said, yeah. I says, you know, I'm sorry. You know, we can't solve this problem when you're going to use that, when you know, going to scream at me like that. And I heard him slam his phone down. He came out of his office. He came over to my desk. And I'm kind of a small guy, and he's kind of a big guy. And he began pounding on my desk, screaming at me. And I told him, I am sorry, very calmly. I am sorry, but you and I cannot solve this problem until you're willing to calm down. And he had like tears in his eyes and stormed out of the office. He walked around the block for a half an hour or so. He came back and we had a 15-second conversation and solved the issue. And I worked for him for 2 more years and he never yelled at me like that again. And what had happened is, when he was yelling at me, the first thing I did was I acknowledged how I was feeling. And I felt horrible. I felt like crying. I felt like shrinking. I felt fear. I felt anger. And then I breathed with it. I was right, my stomach right here was all clenched up. And I just breathed. I just gave space to my breath and to all my emotions. And that allowed me to find my ground. And he could not assail me from that place because I was willing to give space to what I was feeling first. So something else happened that was an example of being able to give space in my own life and to kind of work through my fears. And you know, we do these practices, we come to our Sunday night Sangha, we go on retreats, we have our daily practice, we try to do all the practices, you know, practice good ethical behavior. And sometimes we don't really know if our practice is working. You know, is this thing working? Because nothing major is happening in our lives. But it's when something really intense might happen that we begin to realize whether the practice is working or not. And about a little over 2 years ago, my mom passed. She passed away. And, you know, she was really, and the relationship I had with her, there was so much fear in a way. There was a lot of love too, but also I learned so much fear from her. You know, I remember like flying back to the East Coast for Christmas, and it was always so intense to fly back to New York. It was just like, oh my God. And then when I was there for the holidays and I had to like go on a plane to come back over, it was like, God, am I going to get out of Manhattan alive? And you know, it was just like really intense. So I imagined that when my mom would pass, it would be a very intense thing, and it would terrify me. I would just lose it. And I kind of imagined this for years and years. And then in March of 2013, I got the phone call from my brother. And he said, you know, mom is unresponsive. And the hospice folks are giving her, she can go at any time. So I made reservation and I got on a plane. And I flew back to New York. And I noticed something very different and unusual about this experience. The moment I hung up with my brother and I made the reservation to sleeping that night, to getting the super shuttle the next day, to getting into the plane, to having the flight, to meeting my brother at the airport, to driving with my brother to his house where my mom lay dying, to being with my mom for 4 days as she lay dying. And actually, you know, there were all sorts of things that happened. She was breathing, and my brother put like a baby monitor in the different rooms of his house so that we could hear her breathing in case it stopped, so that we would know to go. And when I slept there, that's what we would all hear, is her breathing through the baby monitor, just like totally intense. So all this stuff happened, picking out coffins, you know, a casket, grieving, very deeply grieving. It all happened, and not once in 6 days did I anticipate the next moment. I just did it. I did the whole thing. I lived my mom's dying. And I couldn't believe it. I never anticipated what was going to happen. I never catastrophized. It was just all happening. And that's when I knew that my practice was holding me. Because I had given myself space for all these years, I was able to give space for my mom's death and to help her. And she died in our arms. She died in my arms and my brother's arms. So giving space is really about awareness. And awareness is really about holding our experience. And when I think of something that holds experience, I think of a cauldron, you know, a big iron pot. If you have an empty iron pot, inside it there's space. And so like a cauldron, awareness holds our experience. But like a cauldron, it also cooks our experience. It cooks it, it allows us to live with it, to live through it, to learn from it, to grow from it. In that loving awareness, that space of loving awareness, that's where we live. And there's also a little bit of an idea for me from alchemy, the ancient art of alchemy, where they took, the whole idea was to take base metals and transform them into gold. That was the alchemist's quest. And so there's this whole idea about awareness, the awareness that we're cultivating when we give space in our practice. Our awareness transforms our experience into the feast of our life, into the gold of our life. So it takes love and courage to practice the Dharma. So please give yourself space in your life. You deserve it. It's an act of love, after all. And I'd like to end with a little quote from a Zen master called Jizo, J-I-Z-O. He wrote, "Not knowing is the most intimate thing. Not knowing means to be open to all eventualities, to not prejudge a person or situation. If your mind is full of preconceived notions, there is no room for an unbiased view. It is like when your hands are full of objects, you cannot pick up something new. A closed mind causes separation and suspicion. Like an umbrella, a mind is only useful when it is open." So let's sit for a minute before we end.